CliffCentral.com.
All right, that's catchy. It's M.O. with Kamikaze. Sia gives it the stamp of approval, not like Monifa, which you didn't know at all.
It's those songs you don't really need to know the lyrics to. Ticka
party. No, who knows? Anybody know what those lyrics are? Nobody knows. All right, the Free Market Foundation is South Africa's foremost independent policy organization promoting personal and economic freedom, growth, property rights, and the rule of law. Now, who's not for those things? I mean, don't you want as much personal freedom, as much economic freedom as you could possibly get?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want all of it.
Yeah, you want all of that. Exactly. Most sensible people do. And the only people who I think would be against more personal freedom, more economic freedom, is potentially large autocratic governments. But we'll find out from Leon, though. I saw Leon last year sometime, after a very, very long hiatus where I didn't see him at all. But we were actually, years ago, we were on 702 together, many, many years ago. And he has been in charge of, one of the people in charge of the Free Market Foundation for some time now. Leon, welcome. Nice to see you.
Nice to be with you and the listeners.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
Yeah, you've been busy. I mean, there's lots going on. I see that you've got, just this week, you've got somebody talking about the hate speech bill.
Yes, indeed. Yep. So a big issue of interest to you, I know.
Yeah, Rex van Schalkwyk is going to be talking about that. Mm. He's a former judge of the Supreme Court of Appeal, and he's the chairman of the Free Market Foundation's Rule of Law Board of Advisors. So you're interested in the rule of law as well. You're interested in free speech. There's lots of stuff we can get into on that front. But did I give a reasonably good summation of what it is the Free Market Foundation stands for?
Yes, it is. I suppose a bit of flavor to that is that most of our work over the years has been with small and independent businesses. We are for precisely the same freedom for large conglomerates and corporations. So we will come out in defense of Microsoft, for example, if their intellectual property rights are threatened, as they were some time ago. The government adopted a resolution that that government could use only open source software. And our work meant that they had to do an objective choice, not based on some kind of predetermined criterion like that. But nonetheless, our main work is with informal traders. So, for example, when the Johannesburg City Council in 2014 cleared all the street traders off the streets.
I remember that.
There was a constitutional court order. What you won't know is the constitutional court ordered them to let them back, interdicted them. But what you won't know is that we were the ones behind the case. So and to this day, we're fighting that. Right now, the city council police are again raiding street traders. We threatened them with being arrested for contempt of court, the chief of police, the mayor, the executive manager. We got a letter assuring us that they will stop. So we find ourselves in Alex Township dealing with tavern owners, with people with property claims, in rural villages in KZN, dealing with people.
It's a very interesting cross-section of all of society, from a big corporation like Microsoft to informal street traders.
Just about freedom, that's it. So everyone's freedom, regardless of how big or small or any other criterion.
It sounds like a lot of responsibility. I mean, you know, in civil society, we need these kinds of organizations, but you probably need a lot of funding, and you need people who are very passionate about this stuff.
Yes, and we do. I'm pleased to say people like Rex van Schalkwyk, an eminent jurist, and many others, prominent people, Martin Brassey, who for many years was the chief counsel of COSATU and the labor movement, professor of law at Wits, labor law. You know, people like this have given us many, many hours of their work, very passionate about the cause. Mm-hmm. And many people like me, Martin Brassey included, people like John Kane Berman, Institute of Race Relations, migrated from what is usually called the radical left. I was a Marxist. Yes. So people like us, Martin Brassey, you know, we migrated over the years. We believe what we did was see the light, that in fact what matters more is personal freedom than government protection and regulation and control. And Big Brother government, of course, you have mentioned to your listeners the forthcoming budget.
Yes.
Where Big Brother is likely to get bigger. and control more of our lives and take more of our wealth and stifle us more and make everything worse for everybody. This is what happens when governments are big. Free people are less free and less prosperous.
Let's just talk about your own personal migration here. So where did you start off? I mean, how do you square off being a Marxist in your early years? You know, there's that saying, they say that if you don't lean to the left when you're young, you have no heart. Mm. And if you don't lean to the right when you're old, you have no brain.
There's a lot of truth in that, and the saying works because it's true. And old people who haven't made that migration, you know, really haven't thought about things and looked at what happens in the real world. I really mean that. You cannot possibly remain a socialist or a Marxist or a communist or a fascist, all of which are really sides of the same – of one coin or facets of the same coin. You cannot remain that way and think – you cannot, you know, you can't have an informed support for more government when the overwhelming evidence, it's not subject to informed debate anymore. The evidence is completely conclusive that freer economies are more prosperous. They are the ones to which the poor and destitute of the world migrate. We see them trying to get out of Cuba into America, not the other way around, out of North Africa into Europe, not the other way around. When last did you hear of French people fleeing to Morocco or something?
No, see? It doesn't happen.
Or east to West Germany, or from, you know, they get from North to South Korea. You never have people trying to escape from South Korea to North Korea.
No.
So there's always one way, and the poor of the world know something that its lefty intellectuals don't, that the best place to be poor is where the richest people in the world are. So, for example, this Oxfam report that babbles on about too few rich people compared to poor people, what those intellectuals and propagandists at Oxfam, and they are socialists, they are radical lefty anti-freedom people, what they don't get is that the poor people of the world don't agree with them. The poor people of the world know exactly where to go. You want to go to where the Christo Vises and the Bill Gateses of the world live. That is the best place to go if you are poor.
Yeah.
And so the countries with the systems people like Oxfam propagate are the countries the poor are all trying to escape from. And that's very important. People like Thomas Piketty in his famous book also claiming that they're too few rich and too many poor, they are arrogant and wrong. And they are wrong and every poor person knows they're wrong. And the policies they recommend are the policies that keep many people poor. But fortunately, the whole world is actually abandoning socialism and going towards market economies. We in South Africa are one of the few swimming against the tide.
So there are still countries that, like Venezuela, despite all the overwhelming evidence to the contrary, want to give socialism another try. And there are countries like ours where there are people, there are certain elements of our own government who still believe that that would be the most successful form and system of government for us to take up.
Half our ministers, half of all our senior officials are members of the Communist Party who still believe in that system. Now, whether they believe it because they think it's good for society or good for the poor or good for the masses or good for their voters and their constituency, we don't know. Mm. Maybe they just believe it because they're megalomaniacs who want power. I suspect it's the latter. I think they just have an insatiable thirst for power and control. They hate the thought that someone somewhere might be enjoying themselves by having a chocolate, which has to be taxed or stopped. They hate the thought that someone might be enjoying a glass of wine with friends and a meal. They hate the thought of anyone anywhere enjoying themselves. They want to make sure that
everyone is
regimented.
And equally miserable.
Equally miserable, equal misery, equal regimentation. Their vision of a dance floor is where everyone dances in sync. Your vision of a dance floor is where everyone does their own thing.
Okay, so Leon, let's get to the basics here, because people are going to there are going to be some people who already are convinced by what you've said, and there are going to be other people who just ideologically are opposed to what you've said. But let's break it down to its bare essentials. Why is capitalism good?
Well, capitalism is a bad name for the system, and it was coined by Karl Marx, and we never use it. We talk of freedom or liberty or economic freedom or whatever, and the reason is capital, the ownership of capital, capitalism, really explains everything in a communist or a free market country. A communist country is still capitalist. It's just that the capital is in the hands of a few elites, a cabal of people called the government. And in a market economy or free market or liberal or classical liberal, many better words for it, the capital is in the hands of private people. Now, capital is the microphone into which I'm now speaking, is capital. And so capitalism really implies that where the capital is owned by people like you instead of by the government. Now, if you live under a socialist or communist system, which half of the people in our government want, is that you would not be able to run Cliff Central. Yeah. This Cliff Central would be owned and run by them. And you would have only an SABC monopoly as we have an electricity monopoly.
Right.
They want to control electricity. Now, they don't control electricity because they want people to have electricity. They control electricity because they love the power. We don't have electricity.
Well, hang on. Are you saying that they don't – why have an ESCOM if it's not to provide electricity to the people?
If you want to provide electricity to the people, you would do something very simple, and you would allow everyone who wants to supply electricity, which, by the way, is now the system in virtually every country in the world. We have this apartheid dinosaur ESCOM, which was an early model in the early days when electricity was new.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere else in the world now has competing energy markets. A little country like New Zealand, not much bigger than the Kruger Park, well, about twice or three times the size of the Kruger Park, the government runs advertisements inviting people to choose between electricity suppliers. Don't just buy from anyone. Think about who to buy from. But in Europe, for example, you may
say
not
say that again. So if people wanted to supply electricity to South Africa,
they're not allowed to. We have a thing called NERSA, which sounds like nursery. It treats us all like little babies in nappies.
Yeah.
And it regulates licensing. So if you want to – give you a simple example. When Eskom did the inevitable and failed and we had the beginnings of our crisis or our catastrophe – it's not a crisis. It's a catastrophe. It's costing the country something like nearly – R1 trillion a year less wealth than we would have had, according to Davy Ruit, thanks to Eskom. When that happened, the banks in Sandton got together and said, let's buy a generator, put it in a central place so we can all run our banking systems 24/7.
Yeah.
They were not allowed to.
By NERSA.
By NERSA, yeah. So the energy regulator will not allow Eskom, will not allow Anglo American to use its own coal to build a power station to power its own gold mines. It's not even allowed to do its own energy provision. So we have to use a failed monopoly. And right here in this building, I've seen so-called energy-efficient light bulbs. Mm-hmm. No, they're energy-inefficient. They are light bulbs that cost more than they should. They should be cheap light bulbs running on cheap electricity. Instead, we now have to spend hundreds of billions on all trying to avoid consuming something which should be cheap and plentiful.
Let's not forget that part of the reason that we now have enough electricity supply is because the demand has been reduced, not because electricity has been produced.
Yes, yes. If for example, you reduce the supply of T-shirts, then people will consume less T-shirts if there just are less T-shirts. And then they will say, well, there you are. People don't need any more T-shirts. Well, that's nonsense, of course.
So what other examples are there in South Africa of these leftover, these relics of state control?
Well, unfortunately, apartheid lives on in many ways. And probably the biggest and most evil and worst of all is that black South Africans are still living under the 1913 Natives Land Act. It was theoretically abolished, but right near us here, within almost walking distance, is Alex Ronda Township, where black people used to have full freehold title. To this day, they do not. They now are tenants of the state. They are living in the world that Verwoerd fantasized, and Verwoerd's ghost walks around Luthuli House and smiles at the ANC leadership for perpetuating his land policies for black South Africans.
So you're telling me that people who live in Alexandra Township do not own the land on which they live?
No, they don't. And
they used to. They once used to.
They once used to, yes. They were expropriated in 1968 under apartheid. the new government took over, you would have thought the easiest thing in the world is simply restore the title to the legitimate claimants.
And because once people own the property that they live on, they can borrow against that, they can start their own businesses, they're able to leverage some of that wicked capital that you were talking about earlier.
Yes, and they don't even need to leverage the capital. I think the more important thing is actually pride and dignity. Now, we worked with the are working with the Parais, or the Ngwati City Council,
yeah,
municipality. And to their credit, they are considered, let's say, to the left of center within the ANC. They have partnered with us in the Free Market Foundation. We're having a wonderful time over there dishing out title deeds to the residents. And one of them, at one of the ceremonies, Miriam Matupi, was wheeled in a wheelchair, 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was handled a title deed by Chris Tovisa, supposedly the richest, most, you know, evil man in South Africa, actually one of the most wonderful people, he personally went and handed her her title deed, which he funded.
Mm-hmm.
And she wept. And one of the journalists said, "Why does this matter to you?" Not saying explicitly, but implying, at your age, does it matter whether you have a title deed? And as tears rolled down her cheeks and down the cheeks of everybody watching, she said, "I can now die with dignity and I have something to leave my grandchildren." She said, "I've lived in this house for 50 years and never been allowed to own it. At last I do. I'm now ready to die." Now, that is how important it is, and that is what was denied people under apartheid and still denied people to this day.
Leon, this is disturbing to me because you would think that one of the first things that, this government would do is to allow people to have access to the property that they already occupy.
Yes,
in terms of owning that land and having property.
But if I were to say to you, why do you think they didn't?
Okay, well,
why do you think? I mean, the interesting thing is they babble on about redistributing land, by which they mean some farmland. They want 30% of the land, quote unquote, redistributed to black people. They don't mean that at all. What they mean is they want to expropriate 30% of white commercial farms, which means nothing to any black people. None of the black people in this building will get any benefit from that so-called land redistribution at all. And what they do in the meantime is they hold on to up to 10 million people who already occupy land, who they could just, at no cost, no conflict, nothing, just give them a title deed. Now, why don't they? The answer has to be naked lust for power. They love control over people.
So this is a handle on which, by which to grab people and to control them.
It's control, it's corruption, it's deciding who lives where. Black South Africans to this day live under house arrest. If you are allocated an RDP house or an old apartheid four-roomed house or Section 293 or 30186, doesn't matter what the provisions are, proclamations,
yeah.
I mean.
See, are you listening? You're under house arrest. Listen to this.
Black South Africans, if they are not found where the government put them with the so-called RDP house, which they so-called own, then the house is repossessed. Whoever is there is evicted onto the pavement. That's today. So the government today does exactly what the apartheid regime did. It decides where black people will live, and they jolly well better stay there or else. If they don't stay there, they get evicted.
This sounds like a conspiracy theory.
It does, and I hate conspiracy theories. I don't tend to believe them. That's why my theory is naked lust for power, insatiable power.
Leon, I can't believe this. You're telling me that all of these houses, and we've built a lot of houses over the last couple
4 million.
Years. Right. It's one of the few things that our government can be very proud of.
Very good. It's a fantastic accomplishment.
And there are more and more being built.
Yeah.
And in certain parts of South Africa, it's a real success story.
Yes.
You're telling me that the people who occupy those houses don't own them?
Yes, they're subject to a preemptive clause, it's called, which means if for 8 years they are not personally in occupation. Now, bear in mind, you put someone in a house in Stanger or somewhere. They don't have a job. They can get a job in Durban or Port Elizabeth or, you know, Greytown or something. Mm-hmm. And now they can't move. The law says you stay where you are unemployed or else you lose your most valuable asset. If you want to move, if you let it or sell it or whatever, let me just tell you what happened in Parais, for example, North Free State. We sent out somebody to 10 people, the first 10, to invite them into the law firm, the municipality's law firm, to sign the documents to take ownership. They knocked on the door. They said, if you come next week to the lawyers, you can just sign the documents. You can get your property for free, no cost.
Mm-hmm.
Guess how many of the 10 actually arrived? The answer is zero.
Why?
Eventually, we went to find out. They shut the door in the face of the people who came. And after much effort with community leaders and political leaders from various parties, we found that they thought it was a trap to force them to start paying rates, which some were outstanding since the rent boycott of the 1970s, up to 200,000 rand owing on a plot of land in a shack. Hmm. Now, then they didn't believe that this was going to happen. They thought it was a trap and a catch. Wow. And they even had community organizations telling them, don't fall for this ploy. We eventually won their confidence, and now they are busy taking title. There are now something like 3,000 deeds that have been issued. And the premier of the Free State, Asma Khushula, said he wants the Free State to become the first province in South Africa with us as partners where everyone owns their land under exactly the same unrestricted, freely tradable title.
That's very good.
It is good, yes.
Yeah.
And you'd think we would get lots of support. You'd think he would clear his desk, call in his staff, and say, all you are allowed to do for the next year is issue title deeds. We had a nice meeting, nice cup of tea, shook hands, and then he went away and forgot about it.
And you guys are left doing the work.
We left doing the work, battling away with...
So how does someone like Christo Visa get involved in this?
He read about it in the newspaper, and he called me, and at the time Herman Mashaba, who was our chairman, and he said, can we have a meeting? And we flew down and met with him in his Pep Store office, which, for what it's worth, people think of him as this rich mogul. He works in an industrial area of Cape Town,
yeah,
in a modest office.
In the same office he's occupied for like 20 years.
For many years, yes. Right. And we met with Christo, and he said, this is a no-brainer. He said, this has got to be done. He said, why hasn't it been done? And he said he would sponsor, started personally out of his own pocket, a few hundred titles. It costs about 2,000 per title. So anyone out there who wants to get involved, 2,000 rand, you can give someone a home. And then we arrange to go and visit and have a cup of tea and meet the people who've become empowered. And then I must say others, like the other supposedly evil capitalist, Johan Rupert,
mm-hmm,
said the same thing. And I don't know if I'm free to mention the amount, but he personally, out of his own pocket, not corporate money, gave us a few million rand for title deeds. He said, go out and give. And these are people who,
this is white monopoly capital.
This is evil white monopoly capital. Yeah,
these are the people who our president tells us we must remove in order to radically transform things.
Yeah. And how many title deeds has the president sponsored?
I don't think the president owns his own land.
He doesn't. No.
Because the king does.
Well, you've just given me an idea. Maybe we should go and get him a title deed.
I don't see why not. He doesn't own – everybody's all upset about Gandla, right?
Yeah.
And what's been built there. But he doesn't actually own the land on which Gandla stands.
For 2,000 rand, we can let the president own his own land.
I think we should
empower – and thereby end apartheid.
Well, let's at least empower him in terms of his own property.
Yes.
Maybe then he will feel that what it's like – because this is the truth, is that once you've paid for and owned – your own land, and not even in this case paid for, because it's the land that many people have occupied for generations already.
Yes.
Once you have that land, you're a real person who can participate in the economy.
Exactly. And you know, the banks don't even need a mortgage. They just say, if you own a tradable asset, then you are what they call bankable. You can get credit cards, you can get micro loans for education and business and so on, and buy a car. They don't even need a mortgage. On small land, it's actually not even worth mortgaging. They just will give you banking facilities because you are a landowner. But you know, the more important thing I get back to is not the economics. That is important, but the dignity. Now, as a sociologist in Brazil put it, when they were turning their slums, their favelas, into freehold title, a leftist socialist sociologist who was against it,
mm-hmm,
when he saw what happened, he came up with a beautiful phrase. He said, I couldn't believe it. People started going home with a tin of paint instead of a bottle of brandy. And you can see it here how people start improving their homes in Paris. On the day the deed was issued, there was a pile of bricks outside one of the shacks that was getting a title deed. 6 months later, you cannot improve. And we're monitoring all, by the way. We take photographs before and after. You cannot believe how within days people start painting, start replacing steel doors with wooden doors, start adding on extra rooms, start planting gardens, start putting up garden fences. The pride, the dignity, the love, the people in finally having their own home and not living as wards of Big Brother government.
So how did your metamorphosis from lefty socialist into free market capitalist happen?
Okay, Gareth, I know you're an intellectual and you like to think that I read some profound book on philosophy or economics, Hayek or Friedman or something. I'm sorry to say no. It was much more mundane and I'm almost embarrassed by this.
Yeah.
I was a young legal article clerk, hardcore lefty activist, anti-apartheid activist. I'm proud to say I always was and still am. Uh-huh. What's left of apartheid, uh-huh, which unfortunately is a lot. And what happened is I walked out of my building and a little old lady who sat on the corner of Brie and Rissik Street selling fruit out of a basket on the sidewalk, I saw her get up and run around the corner. I couldn't understand why. And then I saw a police vehicle pull up. In those days they were called traffic cops, now Metro Police. And one got out and chased her around the corner and the other one got out and kicked her basket so that her fruit rolled across the road and picked up her cash. Little bag. The other one came back and they bundled her in a very rough and violent way into the back of the police van and drove off. I was just gutted and I didn't know. I'd abandoned my work for the day, nearly got myself fired and nearly had my articles terminated. I went to the police station, the traffic department it was called, and I remonstrated with them. And who did I meet there? A guy called Lawrence Mavundler, who was a trade unionist in the mine workers industry, and he now has an office very near where you are at NAFCOC. He's the president of NAFCOC and now a prominent black businessman. Mm-hmm. And he was there doing the same thing. He was fighting for some street traders. And the two of us met, and we've been friends ever since. We work with each other to this day. Now, went away from that situation and I thought, but hold on, the philosophy I subscribe to, socialism, means that the cops were right. She's a capitalist. She's running a business. And under my belief, socialism and communism, she shouldn't be allowed to do that. So I thought, but that can't be right. Here's a harmless person,
yeah,
selling other poor people, you know, one milli or one apple or a little bunch of grapes or whatever. And she gets brutalized like this. And that actually made me reconsider my entire philosophical paradigm. And I thought, no, actually, the world I want is a world in which people like that are free. And people like that can become Bill Gateses of the world. Mm. In fact, most of the very rich people in the world, like Anton Rupert, Sun Na Yuan, started rolling cigarettes himself by hand. He was an informal backyard operator. So, and many, many, Sears and Roebuck, the biggest businesses in the world, Walmart, these are all people who started as street traders and informal businesses. So that actually, that incident made me completely change my beliefs to believing in personal freedom and personal enterprise. Now, unfortunately, I only much later discovered the philosophical validations for this.
But that's okay, because sometimes personal experiences better than reading someone else's ideas.
I think so, and I think it makes me really understand why there is no difference between the rich who became rich honestly and the poor. And whether you're a laborer or a street vendor or a backyard operator or a mogul flying around in your private jet, you have the same rights, the same dignity, the same legitimacy, and deserve the same recognition and protection.
So what are the alternatives? I mean, it isn't just socialism and capitalism.
No.
I mean, we've got a bit of a mix in this country.
Every country has. Never has anywhere been purely one or the other. When I was a communist, I used to read Mao's little red book. Mm-hmm. By the way, it was quite difficult because you needed to know which version of it you were allowed to read, because they kept producing new ones. And then if you were caught in possession of an old one in China, you were imprisoned. But Mao's little red book used to complain bitterly about how property owners kept trading property, and instead of being little peasant farmers, they became big commercial farmers. And I thought, but that's strange. I thought all the land under communist China was state-owned. It turned out that actually it varied a lot from province to province in China. It is and always has been a federation with lots of internal diversity. So they never successfully got rid of all private land ownership. They certainly never successfully got rid of all private business. And that is probably why China, now that it's going capitalist or free market, can be such a spectacular success, because it allowed, and Mao even allowed, and could not stop the level of enterprise that took place. So every country is a mixed system. So what we do instead is we look at indices of different systems. Which countries are closer to one side or the other? Which countries have freer economies or less free economies? And the evidence is, this is where the issue is settled beyond any legitimate discourse. Overwhelmingly, countries with freer economies are richer, more popular, more peaceful, they have less crime, they have less alcoholism, they have higher life expectancy, more literacy, less child and women abuse, etc., right, etc. Countries with bigger governments, with more socialism, more control, where government supposedly looks after people,
yeah,
those are the countries from which people want to escape. Well, they're the countries where people die or sick and live in squalor and misery.
Let's look at the example of mental health patients here in Gauteng, recently in the news. That's where you trust the care of those people to government, and look what happens. They die.
Well, if you discuss this much more, I will start sobbing and weeping right here on the program, genuinely, because as it happens, my daughter is a severe schizophrenic, and we have just admitted her to Hill and Joseph Hospital, which is the only hospital where we can have somebody who needs medical care and psychological care simultaneously. It's been the most horrible week of my life, getting her in there violently, forcefully, traumatically. And I can see the state of a state hospital when things are in there, of a state psychologist. I've got a child there now, right now as we speak. She was moved in a government ambulance from Tara to Hill and Joseph, knowing that nearly 100 people have been killed in that process by the government. So that's where I sit right now personally, with my own child in that situation. So, yes, it is ghastly beyond words. It is ghastly beyond words that people like my beloved child are killed by the system. Now, it's quite interesting. The law makes it such. You might be sitting there thinking, but surely Leon Lowe can afford to have his child in a private hospital. Well, maybe not. I'm not. That would be difficult for me financially. That's not the issue. The law makes it such that a private hospital will only take a patient under her circumstances if they are there voluntary. She would have to volunteer, but she's catatonic and physically and mentally incapable of doing so. So we are forced, the wealthiest people are forced, to put their children in that system you've just described. Now, just think of this. The DA rates the Minister of Health, Aaron Motsoaledi, as the best minister or one of the best ministers in South Africa, and he is in charge of the most despicable healthcare system imaginable. You should see the place. It is filthy. It is run down. It stinks. The stench is. One of the things I've thought I will do when she's no longer there is go there, literally hire some people and go and paint the wards that she's in, just as a kind of little tribute to the nurses who work there. Wonderful people, doctors, nurses, caring, wonderful people, under the most ghastly conditions. I've got through saying this without sobbing, but it's not easy. I've got a lump in my throat as I speak.
I'm sorry. I didn't even know that that was the case, and it wasn't my intention to bring it up in order to upset you, but I think that it's a valid point that you make. You're showing how these things affect you and I. And everybody else.
Everybody. You know, so we read in the paper 90 people who die in psychiatric care of the
94,
state.
94, I think.
94. you know, it's a number. But you happen to be speaking now to somebody for whom that is the real world.
Yeah. You know, to move on without being, you know, in any way glib about that, because it's a serious thing. But there are other things that I just do not understand, and perhaps you can explain them to me. The sugar tax. What is the sugar tax, Leon, and what does this mean?
Well, firstly, the same minister, Aaron Motsoaledi, is a Puritan and I believe a reformed drinker and smoker.
Yeah, those are the most dangerous kind.
Yeah, and he is a messiah who wants everyone else in the world to live according to what he thinks is a good idea. He says, for example, I'm a lifelong non-smoker, but his line is smoking has no benefits. Now, I don't have to smoke to know that the benefits it has for smokers, which are documented by the World Health Organization, include such things as coping with depression, coping with anxiety, coping with social problems, people who have difficulty socializing, loneliness, stress, whatever.
Just relaxing at the end of the day.
Enjoying yourself, sure. So Aaron Motsoaledi does not regard pleasure, happiness, and contentment as a value. This is worth nothing. He does not want people to enjoy themselves. And if he believes that someone somewhere enjoyed a cold drink, it distresses him terribly. So what he wants to do is stop anyone having fun anywhere.
Mubs, put that soft drink down. How dare you?
Yes, absolutely despicable. So he regards, and the government regards, his department regards, the sugar tax was passed on to the department, to the Treasury, because the Department of Health can't impose tax, but it's their idea, and they're the ones who justify it. What they want is for people who enjoy themselves to stop doing so. They regard you and every listener out there as a biological process without a mind or a psychology or a will or a desire or an emotion. They want you to be physically, biologically what they consider healthy, and it's regardless of how that affects whether you enjoy your life or not. And so they are now taxing sugar, but understand their reason for taxing sugar is important. It is not because sugar, which apparently it does, causes internal inflammation and maybe plaque and other things, doesn't
matter. Sure, it's not the greatest
concern,
stuff in the world.
Their concern is obesity. Sugar, according to them, is the biggest cause of obesity, and sugar in sugared drinks, Coca-Colas and so on, are the worst cause. So now they're going to tax that. So what they're actually taxing is obese people. We shouldn't call it a sugar tax. We should call it a fat tax.
Okay.
And the evidence is very clear that this is a discrimination against people who happen to have a sweet tooth. Now, I can see you're not obese, so I presume you somehow...
You can't see under the shirt.
Oh, I can't. Okay. But
In this studio, none of us are.
None of you. I look around the studio. None of you are examples. No, but the point is that...
Is this discrimination?
Yes, it is. Obese people are going to be subsidizing us. We who are not obese will now have our health care subsidized by people who are. By being taxed. And what's happening is this is apart from people who are already socially stigmatized.
Yeah, they already have to deal with problems. People like me saying horrible things about them.
Correct. They've already got, and now the government comes and says we're going to penalize you financially because of your lifestyle.
It seems brutal.
It's brutal, it's cruel, it's inhumane, it's discrimination, it should be unconstitutional. And, you know, when I came out as a non-smoker in favor of the rights of smokers,
yes,
people all said to me, why do you do that? What's wrong with you? Smoking is bad. It's unhealthy. And I said, if you allow the principle in this case, you will have no principle defense when the next thing comes.
And they always pile
sugar,
on, right?
Salt.
I mean, look at freedom of speech, because this is the other thing I want to talk to you about, because it's one of the personal freedoms that I'm very uptight about.
And you are going to be talking at the Free Market Foundation.
I am.
About it.
Indeed. Yeah. When is that? That's happening, I think, in the next 2 weeks or so. I'll give the exact date in a moment. Yeah. But freedom of speech is something that, to me, is about as close to sacred as something is allowed to come.
Yes.
And nothing is sacred. Even freedom of speech has its limitations. You can't go around inciting violence, for example. That would be counter to civilized, sophisticated social behavior.
Yes.
Okay, but there are things about free speech that we must take for granted because we've fought hard for them.
Yes.
One of the things that bothers everybody is this disgusting hate speech bill that they're going to bring, which will mean that Sia, Mabali and I can't talk about anything. Because if someone somewhere is offended, we could go to prison.
Yes.
Just for ridiculing something they think.
Yes,
there's no diversity of ideas allowed in this world.
Freedom means something really very, very simple and basic. It means the right of other people to do things that offend you. If you are in favor of other people doing only what you approve of, you are not for freedom. You are for dictatorship and despotism. The extent to which you are comfortable with other people doing things you think they shouldn't do.
Yes.
Including insult you.
Yes.
Or eating sugar. Or drinking too much beer.
Smoking.
Or smoking. Or having salt. Or having fatty chops. Or having fast food. Or all of the things that our puritanical government is trying to stop us doing. Then you are not for freedom. Freedom means respecting other people's differences. So, if you see somebody, for example, drinking too much, their freedom permits them to do it. Your freedom permits you to try and persuade them not to, to inform and educate and persuade. It does not permit you to interfere with their chosen lifestyle or speech. And you're absolutely right. Free speech is the pivotal of freedoms because it is the thing that enables us to protect other freedoms. If there is no freedom of speech, I can't come here and propagate property ownership for black South Africans. If there's no freedom of speech, I will not be able to come here and call the sugar tax despicable and inhumane and discriminatory.
Right.
And a vicious attack on fat people. By the way, the evidence is very clear. The Department of – just before we get off this, get back quickly.
Sure.
Their budget of the revenue they're going to get from the so-called sin tax, now sugar tax, in future it'll be salt and junk food and fast food and so on. Their budget presupposes no reduction in sales. In other words, the money they generate, the extra revenue they generate, is money people have diverted from healthy things – gym, education, school, car, housing, furniture.
So they're assuming it won't change behavior.
It won't change behavior.
In which case, why enact legislation which is patently there to change behavior if you're so concerned about fat people?
Because it makes them feel good. They believe they're doing something. They get money, of course. It feeds into their trough where they can all suck at the teat of state. And so the point is it's actually a healthy tax. It's a tax on healthy things.
Yeah.
Healthy stuff, money you would have spent on good things is diverted into what they consider bad things or sin. Now, free speech is one of these things that is very difficult because when I studied law in the 1960s and 70s, was always uncomfortable, for example, about the defamation law, the idea that I can't defame you. You see, my concern is your reputation doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the rest of us. It's what we think about you.
Yes.
You have correct. No right to what we think about you. And so I was bothered about that, you see. And I always thought you should be – and if I'm free to defame you, then it loses currency. If I go around saying you're a pedophile or you're a something or other, it will have no weight unless it's declared unlawful. Then people assume I would only say it if it's true. So the problem with restricting free speech is that it gives validity – to scurrilous things people say. Paradoxically, it actually elevates bad speech to legitimacy. Because now people think, well, Leon Lowe would never say that about Gareth Cliff unless he was on safe ground, unless it was true, unless he knew what he was saying.
Right.
But if I can say nonsense about you and everyone can say nonsense about everyone else, it'll carry no currency.
So
no one will pay any attention to it.
We don't need defamation laws.
No, we don't. Free speech should mean free speech. And this nonsense that you can't make somebody upset means you have no free speech, but you have no freedom.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for example
– you're speaking my language.
Yeah. Now, and I have heard you and read you on the subject, and I'm in complete agreement. And if you and I agree on something, then it's clearly objectively true.
Let's just talk about some of the other things that are going on in society at the moment. Are you concerned about things like state capture at the Free Market Foundation?
Yes, but interestingly, we don't like state capture. And,
but I mean, you support the Guptas' right to do their business here.
Absolutely. I support their right, and I support the right of anybody to lobby the government. I just condemn the government when it submits to a lobby and does a cozy relationship. No, the most dangerous capture, strangely enough, is not businesses, which everyone thinks.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example of state capture. Eskom has state capture. It has captured the state, and the state now gives it a government. SABC, South African Airways, has state capture. It has captured the treasury. In other words, it just runs at permanent inefficiency and losses and just gets bailed out year after year after year by people who don't need it. They're perfectly happy to fly with other airlines.
Right.
Now, the probably the worst form of state capture is often things people know almost nothing about. Probably the most powerful people in South Africa.
Yeah.
Are people called the Financial Services Board.
Oh.
Now, you, Gareth, should be deeply embarrassed and bow your head in shame, because I'm going to predict that you can't name me one of the members of the Financial Services Board.
No, I can't.
Well, you are. This is shameful and disgraceful. The Financial
Why
Services
Why should we know who these people are?
Because they are the most powerful people in South Africa. They can do what Parliament cannot do.
What's
They're
that?
An autonomous agency who make their own laws. They can make any law they like regarding the financial sector. They implement the laws. In other words, they're the lawmaker, the legislature. They're an autonomous agency, not even answerable to the minister or parliament.
Who constitutes them?
They're constituted by an act of parliament. And there's now a law going through, the Financial Services Amendment Law, which will give them even more power. They make the law, they implement the law, they police the law, they run kangaroo courts called tribunals, they adjudicate, they prosecute, they impose fines, they collect the fines, they keep the fines, and they impose levies, taxes. So they are what Professor Robert Vivian, law professor at Wits, calls a state within a state. They do all the functions of state at multi-billion rand levels behind closed doors, and no one knows who they are.
All right, well, do you know who they are?
No.
What do you mean? Can't we look them up?
We can. There's a picture of them on the internet. You can go to their website. You can see their names and their faces. And if you know any of them, then you're unusually well informed, and I will withdraw my condemnation of you for not knowing them.
Let me go and have a look. Financial Services Board.
Yeah.
So what kind of things do they do?
They, for example, have driven virtually all black brokers out of business. They went to Parliament 2 years ago and boasted that they had deregistered 15,000 independent brokers. So one of the most flourishing areas of enterprise in South Africa was the black brokerage business. There are virtually none left. And if you meet an insurer, say to them, do you know of a single black broker?
There isn't one.
Very few know of them, and there are some, but very, very few. Now, they are proud, and the only credit they can claim is about how many people they've driven out of business. Now, you don't need to know much to know what color they were on average, what color their customers and clients were. And so what they have done is they have regulated and stifled and taxed every financial service you get, banking services, insurance services, investment services, accounting services, costs probably twice as much as it would have because of them. And there are fewer people supplying you with services. And they pride themselves on how they throttle the provision of services, and they regulate what people may do for each other. So, for example, the National Credit Act, which is not them, it's the National Credit Regulator, but it's a sister association with similar powers, has the effect that rich people are offered unsecured banking services because banks will not lend to poor people who need the money.
Sure.
Because if they do so, it's defined as reckless lending.
Huh.
So there are now bureaucrats who decide to whom you may lend money. And if you lend money to needy people, it's called reckless lending, and you can be prosecuted. Certainly you can have the debt written off. So if you're a lender,
unbelievable,
a credit provider, a shopkeeper, credit provider, the last thing you want to do is give credit to someone who needs it.
Yeah.
Because the law says if you do that, we'll punish you.
unreal. Mm. It seems completely counterintuitive.
Well, it's not if you assume that the people with power have a vested interest in their own interests. They want to divert wealth and power and status to themselves from the rest of society. So they are actually very clever people. They're doing a great job. In fact, people say governments are inefficient. I say no. Governments are actually the most efficient organization ever invented. They serve the interests of the people who run them spectacularly. Can you imagine Pick and Pay making money by not delivering what it sells to customers? That's what the government does.
Well, that's ridiculous.
So the government has the biggest market share. It grows faster. It outperforms churches, companies, clubs, private individuals. Government is by far the most successful organization in South Africa, in the world. It's astonishingly successful at growing at everyone else's expense. I would encourage everyone, for example, on the budget speech comments by economists today, to read Davy Roets. Davy Roets, prominent South African economist, points out how the government has grown at the expense of the rest of society and in this budget will grow even more.
So what does the Free Market Foundation propose we do about all of this? Because it doesn't seem to be right. Oh, here's the FSB board. So there's someone here called Francois Groepe, Hamilton Ratchefola, Philip Sutherland, Abel Sitole, who's the chairperson, Jabu Mogadime, Olano Makubela, Hilary Wilton, Zarina Bassa, Dudum Somi. I know Dudum Somi from somewhere. And Diane Turpin.
You're not confusing him with Welcome Somi, the entertainer.
No.
No, okay. Okay, well, there you are. You might know one.
One.
Now, these are probably the most powerful people in South Africa. They can do what Parliament can't do. Just make a law behind closed doors in what I call a smoke-free room.
It's very disturbing. This sounds like the kind of stuff you hear on conspiracy theories.
Those few people run an organization which is – you cannot believe what it does to the
accountable to nobody.
Accountable to nobody. They do, in fact, report to Parliament, but they don't have to. They are not under the minister. They're an autonomous agency.
Can you believe this?
Yeah. I feel like, but then we're screwed.
Yes.
And, to put it by, mildly.
I'm feeling a little bit depressed.
And Gareth, okay, maybe I'll cheer you up. Hopefully I'll get a chance to do that before we go. But Gareth said, what do we do about it? And the answer is what you're doing. Broadcasting, covering it, exposing it, critiquing it. Talk to people, inform people, create an informed public, an informed climate of opinion where people say, hold on a sec, we fought for freedom. We're losing that freedom. How do we get it back? And that's a very difficult issue. People think that if you have a vote, you're free. No. It's like prisoners having a vote for who the prison warder will be.
Yeah.
That's not a real vote. And so what you want to do is understand these issues. And the only thing we can do is what you do. You use us. You do the research and the study and the analysis.
We put it out there.
You put it out there. And that is thanks to you, and that's what we must all do. And we must try and inform opposition politicians. By the way, let me just give you some good news. We've been campaigning against the new liquor bill. Now, we could talk about that, but
What do they want to do there again?
Well, they just want to basically reinstate Verwoerd's concept of not having liquor licenses in black areas. This is Verwoerd's ghost again, running the ANC.
Why are people so – they pretend that they don't like H.F. Verwoerd and apartheid and his policy, but
– they love it.
But they love it because it's about statism and control.
State control and treating black people like children, like inferiors.
Because there are a lot of people who say that there's a conspiracy theory that the ANC themselves want to keep black people where they are.
Well, of course, I think any government wants to keep its subjects where they are. I don't think it's – you see, in South Africa, these things often become – yeah, that's right. These things become racial. You know, your statement was the ANC wants to keep black people where they are. No, I think that's – putting too much of a racial flavor to it.
Okay, they want to keep
Governments want to keep citizens where they are. All governments want to keep all citizens under their control. But the ANC, let me point out that some members of the ANC in Parliament, for the first time I'm aware of, came out and said they reject and will not support the liquor bill. So finally, members of Parliament are actually doing what they meant to do, which is to decide what the law should be and not simply rubber stamp what is dished up to them by the bureaucrats in Pretoria. So the ANC members of Parliament have broken ranks, members of the port, and that's wonderful news. This liquor bill, it's hard to tell you what it says, but here's a wager. Anyone who can find a single property in South Africa, anywhere, just one piece of land, where a new liquor license would be lawful under this bill, gets a prize. We are offering a prize to anyone who can work out, just find one piece of land anywhere. Now, I'll tell you why it's not possible. Because firstly, it says that you may not be within half a kilometer of, say, a transport facility. What is that? A bus stop, a taxi rank, a station, half a kilometer of a transport facility, Gautrain, that means no liquor license in Sandton City. The Cape Town waterfront is a harbor, it's a transport facility, right? No liquor license in the Cape Town waterfront. No liquor license at Sun City because it's not a zoned area, which means a proclaimed township. So Sun City wouldn't be able to sell liquor. Nothing within half a kilometer of a residential area. Well, that is all black townships. No black township in the whole of South Africa anywhere would be able to
get
a liquor.
How would we make it through the day without liquor?
Yes. This is the bill now before Parliament approved by the Cabinet.
Insane.
It is insane. It is nuts on steroids. I don't know if what nuts look like on steroids, but they're scary.
Leon, there's so many other things that the Free Market Foundation does, and I didn't want to turn this into a discussion just around the free market system, Free Market Foundation, but also about you. What are you putting the majority of your effort into? I know that these title deeds are an important part of it. We've covered some of that. What other stuff is the Free Market Foundation doing now that we need to know about?
The big items on our agenda is the rule of law is a big and relatively new one. We've launched two rule of law initiatives. One is what we call our rule of law project that Judge Rix von Schalkwyk and other prominent lawyers are part of. And the reason for that is that, unfortunately, in South Africa, we have a section one of our constitution says we founded on the supremacy of the rule of law and the constitution. The rule of law is equal to the constitution according to section one.
That's important.
That's one. Now, how many people know what it means? You see, most people think the rule of law means law enforcement. But actually, the rule of law means a whole range of jurisprudential concepts. It means, for example, separation of powers. So the Financial Services Board should not be doing lawmaking, executive functions of government, the branches of government, and the judiciary should all be separated. The legislature should legislate, the executive execute, the judiciary adjudicate. That's the separation of powers. Unfortunately, that has virtually disappeared in South Africa. We now have endless things called tribunals and courts and
special commissions of inquiry.
And commissions of inquiry and things like, what are they called, ombuds and so on in government, which are kangaroo courts outside the judiciary. That's now the norm. Every new bill creates a new government executive court. The lawmaking function has been delegated from Parliament. We have many new laws, but they're not made in Parliament. They're made in Pretoria. Parliament used to make about 100 laws a year in 94. It now makes about 20, if that. Because the lawmaking function has been stripped from Parliament and passed on to the executive. So we want to get people to understand and reinstate the separation of powers. The other one is that laws ought to be objective. The rule of law in the old days meant the rule of law as opposed to the rule of man. In other words, if your rights and obligations are decided by a law instead of a person, then you have the rule of law. Now, an example of where you have the rule of man is taxi licensing. Some official decides whether you get a license, gives A license, but not B.
Just a person. Whoever.
The person gives A a license, but not B. That is the rule of man, or, you know, that's gender insensitive, rule of person or whatever. But the point is, the rule of law would have objective principles and criteria the way you have, say, in London, where a London cabbie gets a license if they pass a test, if they have insurance, et cetera, et cetera.
You have to conform to certain requirements.
Objective requirements, right. Then you can run a cab. That's it. Now, that is the same, for example, in South Africa, say, to be an architect.
Yeah.
The law says if you meet these objectives, everybody can be an architect. There is no gatekeeper. However, if you want to mine minerals, then you have to go and ask for favors
from government.
From government officials, and inevitably there's real or suspected bribery and corruption. So there's a government official who can say, I will give you a mining license worth billions of rands. Now, it would be a very strange world if that official weren't wealthy.
I see what you mean. Listen, we're out of time. I would love to carry on this discussion. Perhaps we need a chapter two. Isn't this interesting?
That is a lot to take in.
All right. So demand your title deed if you live in a township. And keep working with the Free Market Foundation and the good stuff that they do. Ask the questions. Put the stuff out there and find out who's on the Financial Services Board. Find out where they live. Find out what they do.
And picket them.
Picket them. Make their lives ungovernable. And let's all talk about this again very soon. Thank you, Leon. Leon Lowe from the Free Market Foundation. We're out of here. Timothy Maurice is next. Whew, busy day today. All right. Thank you, Leon. It was great to see you again. Really was. CliffCentral.com.